This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Hello and welcome to Addiction, an Hour with Hour. I am one of your hosts, John Bruford, joined by my more estimable co-host, or he's the host and I'm a co-host. I'm like the comedy radio sidekick. I'm Woodstock to his Snoopy. Dr. Michael Hour. Dr. Hour, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
I am okay. I'm not terrible.
And I'm better than I look. I feel better than I look.
That's lucky.
Don't give away any secrets here, you know.
I wouldn't. I would never.
People won't recognize me anymore in the future.
No, it's true. I went to see that. There was a newish take on The Bride of Frankenstein recently. I'm not thinking of that for any reason to do this conversation. But seriously. This is the podcast is usually speaking to academics and researchers and experts in their field of various different stripes. It's not all about gambling addiction. It's about addiction as a thing. And slightly different this week because sometimes you have to schedule guests sometimes months in advance, sometimes weeks, sometimes you do it the same day, you know? So this week we didn't have anybody scheduled. So, and it was such a, we had Professor Mark Griffiths on, and obviously that was awesome. Peter Remmers, the episode before that. Also, I mean, you've had like 24 episodes or whatever of magnificence in weightlifting terms or running terms. This would be a week of consolidating your gains. This is the week where we give your brain a rest so you can come back even stronger next week. So myself and Michael thought we would have a bit of a chat about some stuff.
Okay. I didn't know we'd give our listeners' brains a rest. You know, I thought I could go now full throttle, pedal to the metal, technical, statistical numbers, throw around, you know, terminology. Yeah, but
As a guy who
calls stuff like that,
you lift weights, right? You know the period I'm talking about. You can go heavy and escalate for 3 weeks, but yes, then you throttle back for a week.
That's what's happening actually to me at the moment. You know, like I rest for 2 weeks for medical reasons, and then I'm going full in again. So I'm also in a physical consolidation phase.
Nice. So no lifting for you at the moment.
It's horrible. I mean, I have to admit it. You know, I make it sound it's a good thing, but I'm going crazy here. I need it.
Yeah, I haven't lifted weights for quite a while. Can you tell?
Not from the shape of your head.
Oh yeah,
because that's the only thing I see.
I should just keep the camera really close, and then every podcast I do, I'll be like, I've lost loads of weight.
Now in Vegas, in 3 weeks' time, we're gonna hit the gym.
Is
it four? I don't know. I forgot. I lost track. You know.
I also don't know. I need to start planning that trip, don't I?
Man, so I mean, my schedule looks like this. Next week, I go to Greece for a couple of days for a conference in Thessaloniki. Then the week after, I do 1 day in London. The week after, I go to the G2E Asia. Then I come back, I have to do 1 day London again, and then we do Vegas. Whew. Yeah.
Do you ever worry that you'll get home one day and your daughter will think you're a stranger?
Well, she listens to my podcast now.
Oh, shit. Sorry, I shouldn't swear.
But she saw the picture and was surprised that's me.
I
look much better in reality.
I just to tailor this for Michael's daughter then. Scheiße. wow. That's a crazy schedule. Mine is I'll go and do Vegas and that'll be no, basically.
But what
it
I was saying
year.
Is we can hit the gym there, you know? We can see how much I'd like to make you bench 130 kilos. What's that, 260 pounds? I think you can do it.
Well, I wouldn't be able to do it while we're in Vegas. I have a recurring rotator cuff issue on my right shoulder. Which is just something I need to work on. It's okay. Yes. When I was, when my stepdaughter Lorna was 14 or 15, I was a little bit drunk and I said, hey, I bet I can do a press up with you on my back. And so she sat on me and I did a press up. I didn't warm up or anything sensible. I just did a press up and I've had problems ever since. And she just turned 30. So, but of course, you know, I was looking at her and like in my head, she's like 10 years old and tiny. In reality, she was like 14 or 15 years old and 5'10". So, you know, I stand by the achievement, but I could have probably handled it better. But anyway, could I lift 130 kilos generally? Could I bench press it? Probably not. I've definitely pressed 100.
I think you'd do 95, 90, I think you'd do.
But right now, I think I'd struggle to do more than 60.
Yeah, come on, man.
No, I'm not kidding. I'm a weakling, man. I'm soft. I am like a donut.
I'll shape you.
Not in a good way. Well, it's funny. I signed up for a gym because I am acutely aware of the benefits of exercise to the brain. To all aspects of life, but when you can't be asked, it becomes self fulfilling, doesn't it?
You know what's tough when you haven't hit the gym in a while, which is rarely the case with me. I just have to pause now 2 weeks for medical reasons, and then you go there and you do as you did before, and, you know, psychologically, and then the next day, you know, you're really sore. Because you go there, you know, thinking you can continue where you were before and you bench, whatever, you know, or deadlift, whatever you did. And then you pay the price the next day.
Yeah. Because it's going to be worse than that for me. But I'm just going to start from scratch.
Yes.
Because I need that. I need the wellness that comes with.
That's the same
regular
for me.
Exercise.
It's the feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, and the mindlessness, the repetition, the when you're doing something. And I used to get this from running, and now I can't really run anymore. But that your brain is still firing, but you're focused on something so utterly mindless. Really, it's just. You know, with running, it's just putting one foot in front of the other for 3 hours. And with weights, it's, you know, it's like, you know, when you do yoga breathing and you do that, you breathe in for a count of eight, you hold for a count of eight, you exhale for a count of eight. That's a very similar process for me in terms of what happens to my brain as lifting weights. And I've always found lifting weights really, really relaxing.
It is.
Anyway, that's not what we're here for today. I suggested this episode a couple of months ago, and we're finally at a stage where we don't have a guest for next week. And I wanted to have a conversation about terminology and about the importance of terminology because. a criticism that I frequently see leveled at the industry is that of, so, and I think you might very well disagree with me about this, right? In the gambling industry, we use the term gaming and gambling interchangeably. Mm-hmm. And there's no malice in doing that. It's a catch-all expression. And when people hear, when the gambling industry uses it, it's often, oh, look, they're trying to soften it. They're not calling it gambling. They're calling it gaming. They're trying to make it sound cool or like it's a harmless thing or like it's fucking Call of Duty or whatever. And to me, that's not what the industry is doing at all. I mean, I get it. I get what they're saying. But what those critics don't understand is that in conversations within the industry, everybody does that all the time. But what I was thinking about is the importance of that terminology, like how much that one little thing pisses people off and whether that's important. Because I saw a chap's post on Facebook and I can't remember the chap's name for the life of me, and that's going to really annoy me later. But he was talking about how he was defined. He'd been defined in an article or something as a former gambler. Mm-hmm. And of course, he defined himself, as most addicts do, as a gambler in recovery. And understanding that addiction doesn't just leave you because you don't happen to be doing it at that exact moment.
I mean, you're making a good point here with the interchangeable use of gambling and gaming for games of chance products, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about games of chance products. So where the majority of the outcome is determined randomly, like a roulette, like a slot, a blackjack or whatever. And yes, the industry and, you know, researchers even in academic articles talk about, for example, responsible gaming. However, a person would never, a person would never call themselves a gamer, right? So if you went to the casino, you don't call yourself a gamer, or you don't call the person a gamer, you call them a gambler, right? I mean, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because if we want to use the terms gaming and gambling interchangeably, why wouldn't we apply it to everything where it's applicable? You know, the person is not gaming, you know, they're gambling, because gaming refers to a different activity, video games, mobile games, something, you know, with where the majority of the outcome involves a skill.
Yes, but as we've established on this podcast, there is an incredibly large and growing amount of crossover.
Yes.
In that a lot of those gaming products have gambling elements.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, that's also interesting what you're mentioning. And the crossover, doesn't it happen mainly in one direction, so that gaming products include chance elements like, you know, loot boxes? They might even have casino types of elements where, you know, in whatever, of these games, you could also, like, your character could play a casino game or something like this. But it's not happening so much in the other direction, right? So if you visit a typical online casino or you go to a land-based casino, you don't really see, you know, an arcade type of machine there. So, you know, in the break you can go race a car or play Pac-Man or Tetris or anything like that. Isn't it? I mean, am I wrong?
No.
I mean, this is an open discussion, right?
Yeah.
Because why is that not the case? Because maybe it's not interesting commercially, you know, the person playing a pinball machine in the casino, you know, to sort of wind down or take a break or anything like that. But I never actually saw that in any casino.
It's a really interesting idea.
Land-based or online, you know, I mean, you could have a little arcade in there and say, okay, you know, I go, you know, take a break from the slots.
You could also have that. You could have, like, say, I don't know, a pinball table or some arcade machine every five slots or whatever.
Yeah.
So that the staff can just say to somebody, I'll keep your machine for you. I'll keep your slot for you. Let's go take a minute. Let's go do a bit of this or whatever. Or a fucking pub quiz machine or something like that.
Yeah.
Any way to create a cognitive interruption.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fantastic idea.
I mean, I know of attempts. We had a guest here before. What's his name? Amati. You know,
Daniel.
No, not Daniel from the Canadian company, and they developed these mini games. You know, mini cognitive challenges.
Yeah.
And that's something that they want to promote. Like, you know, you see shapes and you have a couple of shapes and you have to tell, okay, what this shape actually is if you sort of have all of the elements here. It's kind of embarrassing that, you know, and right now I can't recall his name. Sorry if you're listening. I still love you.
Well, that happens to me quite a lot. But then, you know, we're putting
hopefully
out
not too often.
But no, we're putting out an episode a week, and it's
yeah, of course.
It's
Richardson. That's his name. Mm-hmm. Richardson.
Is it
Rich? Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Richardson Amati. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
The Power of Micro Breaks. That was our episode January 20th.
Yeah. No, I mean, but, why? Let's, you know, remind a little bit. How do we arrive here at this thought? Because we talked about terminology, crossover, gambling, gaming. I mean, the interesting thing is in the English language, there is actually a different word, gambling, gaming. For example, in the German language, it's called Spielen, like, you know, play, actually playing. So we don't have the difference between gambling and playing. It's not there, you know what I mean? We only have a word Spielen, and that sort of applies to, I don't know, you know, playing with my, I don't know, action figures, you know, or playing the guitar. It's all called playing, you know. And if I play a gamble on a slot machine, it's also called Spielen. So there's just one word here for everything.
But if we tried to do that in the English language, we'd be torn to pieces. The criticism would be so massive.
Yeah, but that's interesting, no? That linguistically, in the English language, you clearly have a recognizable word for different activities, and in the German language, there is none.
What do you have a word in the German language for when you see young lambs frolicking in the fields?
What's the English word?
Gamble.
Okay, really? Nah.
It's spelled differently. Gambol.
Okay, really? I never heard that word before.
I was wondering if there is an equivalent word in German and if it's anything like the word for play.
No, I couldn't tell. I mean, maybe I'm linguistically too uneducated, but nah, I don't think so.
Yeah, your English sucks.
I mean, my German sucks even more. No, but I'm telling you, there is no word, you know, it's called spielen. I mean, for example, in the papers I write, you know, in the academic papers, I also often, you know, then read through the paper. I mean, those are all in English. And sometimes we call, because that's all our papers are about gambling, okay? And yeah. Sometimes I call the individual, you know, the sample, the unit, whatever, player. I call them gambler.
Hey, you gotta watch the hands on the desk. It sounds like a drum and bass session.
Okay, sorry. Okay. I just get so emotional talking about that.
It's okay. Sorry, you were saying.
Now, we call them player, we call them gambler. And yeah, in German it would be easier because they would just be Spieler. But it could be anything.
Okay.
But no, but what you said in the beginning, I also don't think that industry is applying gaming to gambling on purpose, right? I don't think anybody has any hidden agenda.
It's not done cynically, is it?
It's not cynically. It just, happened over time.
But the criticism is either that it's being done cynically to dress up what we do. Or it's being done out of ignorance. Now, it is being done out of ignorance because we don't see the harm in it necessarily. But like the gentleman who was saying about, you know, he's not an ex-gambling addict. He is an addict in recovery. To the person that is in that, that definition's probably really important. You know, my kids said to me a few weeks ago, well, actually they said to somebody else, but I was with them. They were like, our dad's an alcoholic. And I'm like, kids, I'm not an alcoholic. Yeah, you are. And then the youngest said, you basically are. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, I have an abusive relationship with alcohol, but I don't fulfill the criteria, and I've never had a clinical diagnosis of alcoholism.
And you don't drink any alcohol.
And I don't drink it now because I was lucky enough to be able to recognize that I was fucked, and sort of step away from it. Not everybody gets to do that. But the reason that I don't like being defined as an alcoholic isn't anything to do with me not wanting people to see me as that, is because it feels disrespectful for people who are actually fighting alcoholism. Because that's a fucking evil bastard, to put it bluntly. And I haven't had the challenges that they've had. I've had other challenges, but I haven't had that. And I don't want it, I would feel like I was, God, in fancy dress or something, you know, like wearing a costume if I, like, I have other addiction shit going on, but alcohol is luckily not one of them. And so to me, I guess it's slightly the reverse, but it's the same thing. It's the same thing broadly in that I don't want that terminology applied to me, but that's not because of any kind of shame or anything stupid like that. It's actually out of respect. I know several people in recovery, and they're friggin' amazing. Friggin' and just unreal. And yeah, it's out of respect to them and recognition of them and what they've done. I haven't had to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't need that badge because I haven't earned it. So I kind of understand the terminology thing. You know, that the chap was saying about being a gambler in recovery.
I mean, that leads us to an even more interesting topic.
Does it, though?
Yeah. So I was thinking, not that your topic wasn't interesting, but it certainly is. No, I mean, you problem gambling, pathological gambling addiction. I mean, we discussed this with Mark Griffiths, And I think it's really important to emphasize that those are not necessarily the same things. And it's all, you know, based on a framework. And that framework can change over time. Just like, you know, we discussed in a session with him, at some point of time, other aspects were diagnosed as disorders which have been dropped meantime. And if you, you know, behaved in that way before, you were diagnosed, you know, as having like a mental illness, which is not longer the case. And so it's important that all of these psychological disorders are based on symptoms, observable symptoms, or most of them. And these categories, these items, these symptoms can change.
Well, those criteria, like criteria, Mark was talking about.
Yeah, they can change, you know.
But it's the standardization of those is important, isn't it? And in clinical diagnosis, it's I always say that the only part of life where language is super precise and where words are used in their perfect context is the law.
Well,
clinical diagnosis is pretty similar.
In my experience, the law can also be interpreted differently. For me, what's the gold standard is like programming, you know, like you write a code and that code executes what's written there. There is no room for interpretation. Law is maybe the next level, you know what I mean?
That's like slightly different.
You can also follow the structure.
Because programming is an instruction and a translation. Odd example. The law, is it open to interpretation?
No, because
that's the reason for the specificity of language.
Because when I, a couple of years ago, had like pages of legal text in front of me that I had to sign for, you know, like a transaction, I started thinking of it as a code. And, you know, one section refers to the other, et cetera, et cetera. But then in the end, it's also vague, you know. For example, let's say, you know, intent, you know. So, okay, let's say you breach a contract and you pay a penalty if, you know, there was intent. I mean, how do you prove whether there was intent? You know, things like that. But actually, you know, what was I had a thought, and now sort of I got sidetracked a little bit.
Sorry.
About it. Of course, your fault. No, it's not. we were talking about the problem gambling, right? So if you read the DSM-5 criteria, those 9, you know, items criteria for problem gambling, you know, I mean, it's anybody would, I think, understand to some degree, you know, pretty clearly, okay, what do they actually mean? But then, for example, there's one item which says, okay, on a day you lost, so would you, I mean, do you bet more after days you've lost, you know, over the last, let's say, 12 months? I mean, how can a person even tell if this is happening? You know what I mean? Like, is there, I mean, you know, can you actually conceptualize this? Can you measure this cognitively? And then again, it's up to like a clinician to determine this based on what you are saying. So in reality, of course, 10 clinicians will probably come up with 3 different, you know, diagnoses for one individual who tells 10 clinicians the same story. That's just how it is, you know. I mean, in other, like, let's say, more severe conditions, let's say OCD, right? It's, I think, a pretty clear, if a person like, you know, Joey Ramone from the Ramones, you know, he had OCD. And what he did is, so I read the biography, Every time they stepped off the tour bus, he had to go up and down the fence and touch every pole on the fence, you know, bam, 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 bam. That's what he did. I think it's pretty clear that, you know, this is like an observable behavior. You can tell, okay, you know, something's going on here. So there are conditions which are more severe or very specific in terms of the behavior, like trichotillomanie, where somebody's pulling out their hair and stuff like that, or scratching themselves. And there are other, like, gambling disorder, which are harder to categorize, to detect, because it's simply on a continuum. And somehow we have decided, or not we, but, you know, experts have decided, okay, if you meet these criteria, you are there. So I give a good example. So the other day I was reading a report from 26 or 25 where they assessed gambling harm in Australia. Okay, like nationwide. And the PGSI, Problem Gambling Severity Index, has 9 items. And every question item can be answered on with never, sometimes, most of the time, or almost always. And so, and these are the points 0, 1, 2, 3. And so in totality, you can have 27 points, okay, 3 times 9. And the minimum is 0. And it says that if you score 8 points on the problem gambling severity index, you're a problem gambler. So I'm reading this report, and they talk about risky gambling and have awfully high numbers, and I'm checking there. And then they score somebody as risky gambling from 1, right? So if you score 1, can you imagine 1 point? This means any of those 9 questions you answer with sometimes, which pretty much probably everybody does, whoever played, you know, casino games, let's say, over the last 12 months, and then you are at risk of gambling. So when we come back to terminology, let's say you're reading this report, and that report says whatever, 13%, you know, of the population show risky gambling. Then you go back and you read the UKGC prevalence, problem gambling prevalence, and you see 2.7%, and you ask yourself, what the fuck is going on here? You know, why do they report 13% and in the UK they report 2.7%? Then you gotta go into the report and check, okay, what method are they using actually to categorize individuals? And you find out that they are using a score of 8+, and the others are using a score of 1. So you can't just read something and compare it because without going into detail, you know, and finding out what instrument did they use and how sensitive and, you know, was their cutoff value.
Crikey.
And then, you know, we are even talking about problem gambling. And often this is then sort of mixed up with pathological gambling, which, or with addiction. And like we talked, you know, we discussed with Mark Griffiths, there is no such thing as addiction when we talk about gambling, at least from a diagnostical point of view, because it's called gambling disorder. So when they report addiction, or, you know, we have so many addicted adults in the population, etc., they're not using any terminology that's actually sanctioned by any official organization like the WHO or, you know, the DSM-5 in the US.
So it's a good example of a total lack of precision that's just generally accepted. But then sometimes exactly that happens because it is simply easier to understand. If I say to somebody, so-and-so is a gambling addict, they know what I mean. And unless they're a clinician, they're not going to pull me up on using that term.
So what you're saying is that people intuitively have an idea what we are talking about.
Yes. Everybody understands the concept of addiction to an extent, particularly if they have had some addiction experience. But it's often, I mean, language is an incredibly fluid thing. Out of necessity, language evolves all the time, and so the fluidity of language, and a great example of that is if you think back 30 years, people hardly talked about the internet.
Yes.
I remember the first publishing job I ever had, and I was 18 years old, and I remember my editor saying, I'd made some huge boo-boo. He was away. And I'd sorted out the entire issue and I'd forgotten to do the cover. Because, you know, I was 18 years old. It's my first job in publishing. It was like the third issue I'd ever worked on. Got a fantastic issue, no front cover. And he says, maybe we can get something from Capcom. I'm like, okay, how? So, we go to print in a couple of days. And he's like, well, maybe they could email it. And I said, what? Maybe they could send us something by email. What? Well, we can email it and we can get it and use it. And I'm like, no, that word you used, what's that word? And he said, email? I said, yeah, what's that? And he explained email to me. And he's like, you know, if we set it to download overnight and nobody phones in and we'll be able to get this thing. But I remember so distinctly the first time I heard the term email.
That's a good story. I can't really remember anything. partially from the time. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, when I really first, I know I had my first computer late, like in 96, like a PC with Windows and stuff like that. That's
but computing and stuff. Computing and internet.
I mean, I had a C64, like a Commodore. I had an Amiga, or that kind of stuff where we would do basic and, you know, write like simple games and play games and stuff like that. But that was, of course, pre-internet.
But those things are the perfect examples of the fluidity of language.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, we talked about this before, that things like, you know, autism are used now in a much more general context than they would have been before.
Yeah, but I mean, to be honest with you, when I was a kid, like, were there autistic kids in my school? Maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
But they certainly weren't described as such.
And maybe in 20 years, you know, they describe us also differently with respect to different traits.
Yeah, maybe. I remember when I was at school, secondary school, so, and I'd have been about 11 or 12. There was a guy in my class and he had the worst handwriting you've ever seen in your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was like... written by a goat on drugs. And everybody used to really rip the piss out of him for it. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to have watched, because I've always been like that kid who I will read or watch anything that seems vaguely interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I have this ridiculous breadth of bits of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I'd just seen some TV show, a documentary about dyslexia. Mm-hmm. And I looked at his writing and I said, Pete, I think you might be dyslexic, dude. Because there were letters backwards. There were strange symbols that were consistently replacing letters. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what's that?
Yeah.
And I said, honestly, I don't think I can explain it, but talk to the teacher because they should probably know. Fucking teacher didn't know. And I mean, this is like 1986, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, if your teacher back then was like 60, you know, they grew up.
You were screwed. They would have just wanted to beat you. But it was fascinating. And it turned out he was massively dyslexic. He's now an engineer. because it was recognized, and you know, he'd always been treated like he was a dipshit.
Yeah.
But he was super, super smart. He's a lovely dude as well. He probably still is a lovely dude. But it's just this thing of, like, if you say to almost anybody now that you have dyslexia, they will have at least an idea of what you're talking about. And it's a little like autism. Like, I don't doubt that autism was recognized then. I don't doubt that anything. But you say it to somebody now and they generally know broadly what you're talking about. So language not only evolves and is fluid, but it also, there are circumstances socially or sociologically where existing language can kind of come to the fore and be embraced, but also it can dilute the specificity of that language.
Of course.
And I mean, addiction is a great example of that.
Yes. Terminology can change, you know. I mean, also words can apply suddenly to different things, or, you know, than they were actually originally meant for.
I'm sensing you have an example.
Yeah, so I read this book about, you know, religion, and then it said that the, you know, Semitic, actually, like the word which would now be used for, you know, a group of people, was actually meant to describe languages. So actually, you know, Arabic.
Oh, that makes perfect Hebrew, sense, because we use the word semantic.
Exactly. So the word, the like the Hebrew, the Arabic and another language, I forgot which one, they were called Semitic languages because they are basically originate sort of, you know, from the same, from similar roots.
So anti-Semitic as a term,
yeah, it makes no sense.
Should apply to a larger group than it does when we yeah, use that term.
But originally, it was actually meant to describe the languages. And not. I mean, if I talk originally, I'm talking about late 19th century, so not such a long time ago.
So, but you know, a modern equivalent might be if I decided I was anti-Cyrillic.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which would be, you know, I could totally get behind that, because I've always struggled reading road signs in countries that use Cyrillic languages.
I hate it.
But no, that's really interesting. And not least because language is one of the cornerstones of culture. One of the foundations of culture. And sort of the standardization, we might be diving a little deep here, but the standardization of terms is quite fun. And this is really funny, because this ties into some stuff going on in the UK at the moment. We've got people attaching flags to lampposts and shit like that and saying, I'm just being a patriot. If you look at the English language, there are very few languages that have the accumulation of outside influences that English has.
A lot, no?
Oh, it's unreal. I mean, yeah. Every day we use Latin, Greek, but also German, loads of French, Nordic countries, Gypsy, especially in the area I live, Traveller. Traveller influence is massive, especially on slang. But place names, things like that, you know, it's the outside or perceived outside influence on English language is absolutely massive. And yet people don't recognise that's a cultural influence as well. I mean, by definition, it's a cultural influence. But anyway, yeah. Sorry.
No, I mean, you're right, especially the German. I mean, I have this book about English language, which, I mean, I always have to, you know, I sort of browse through it a little bit. And one example, I mean, there are like lots of examples about English words which originate from the German. And one is like deer. Like in German, Tier is the animal. And the deer, you know, in the English language, and loads of others. So it originates actually from the German word Tier for animal, the English word deer.
I'm absolutely positive it's not the only one.
There's no, there are lots of them. Yeah,
there are a lot of German terms that we use because there is no direct translation. Things like Schadenfreude.
Yeah, that's not what I mean, but yeah.
No, I get what you mean. I'm just saying
that. Yeah, also you have this word Doppelgänger, no? You know?
Yeah, totally. Totally. There's an awful lot of quality German terms that are just used as
so
is.
So Schadenfreude is something people would understand in England? Yeah. Really?
Okay. Yeah. And of course, using relatively modern terms, it's taught in schools as this, but the Blitz, to define specifically the bombing of London during World War II. Mm. And of course, that directly comes from, and I think the translation of Blitzkrieg is lightning war.
Yeah.
Mm. But it's really fascinating that truncated version of it is everybody knows what the Blitz is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I knew about Blitz, use it in English from the song It's Ballroom Blitz.
Yes, that one. But it's an education's influence on language is really interesting. But this is a bit of a segue.
But the point actually why we're discussing is that often, you know, especially in gambling, people are very sort of, I don't know, tied to, or how would you explain it, or very rigid sometimes when it comes to certain, you know, categorizations. So let's say I'd have a discussion with somebody and they say, what about, you know, detecting problem gambling analytically using AI in the online world, right? And my response would then be, so what are you trying to detect, you know? And they'd say, yeah, we try to detect, or we detect problem gambling. And I ask them, okay, you know, I mean, how do you do that, you know? And they would be very sort of, you know, adamant about their position. And then, you know, when you take sort of it apart piece by piece, nothing's really left, you know, at the end of the day. Because the first question you'd ask them, how do you actually specify problem gambling in an online gambling world? Yeah, you know, we look at people who have self-excluded, and then we profile those, and those who have self-excluded, you know, they might look, you know, have a specific gambling behavior. And then you would ask, okay, why are you using self-exclusion, but you're talking about problem gambling? Do you think that's the same thing? Yeah, that's pretty much the same thing. And of course, it's not the same thing. I mean, self-excluders are not necessarily problem gamblers, and, you know, the other way around. But, and then, you know, at the end of the day, these are all psychological criteria, like we have discussed now, you know, extensively. You can't administer like a PCR test or by sort of, you know, a device in the pharmacy that tell you based on your saliva, your blood, whether you are a problem gambler or not. So those are all very fluid criteria. And what's happening now especially is that often it's even diluted further, and we are not talking about problem gambling, but we are talking about gambling harm. And we discussed this also with Mark, right? So if you, let's say, I don't know, you know, you like to play poker, whatever, you know, in the evening instead of watching TV, and your wife would say, you know, I don't like you spending time there and not with me watching TV, and I feel bad about it, then, you know, you psychologically, mentally kind of harm her, and that would be gambling harm them. And that would then be sort of replace, let's say, the problem gambling. And at some point of time, you know, if this would be continuously happening in a society, then we would talk about gambling harm. It would actually be perceived as problem gambling. And here, again, you know, it's all about paying attention to the actual thing that we are talking about.
Don't you think that one of the key things in terminology in the context that we're talking about it, I mean, and I think we touched on this with Mark, but that standardization of terms is important in what, particularly when it comes to sharing knowledge, sharing practices, and just making sure that everybody's kind of coming at the same problem from the same direction and understanding what everybody else is doing and being able to define what they are doing. And so for any forward momentum, like, is there a point at which we'll reach a standardized set of terminology for gambling disorder, or is are we just going to be like, oh well, this is just fluid now? So no, I think good luck it's with fluid that.
Because I mean, if you look at the ICD-11, and the other day, you know, because it was part of like a document that I wrote, I again, you know, thought about it intensely, and the ICD-11 are just three items, and these are so extremely vague that anybody could read anything into them. You know, I mean, the DSM-5 at least has 9 items, characteristics, whatever you want to call it, but the ICD-11 is extremely diluted, you know? So, I mean, totally up to interpretation for, you know, a clinician.
But that's going to present difficulties, surely. That person then presents a paper and they say, oh, we did this and this. Yeah, and this.
I mean, the good
and
thing
they
is
use a term that somebody else uses in a different way.
You can't use it really for prevalence because it doesn't translate. It's not a questionnaire, you know? Like the PGSI, the Prognostic Index, is like a questionnaire. Like you can send it out to people to answer. But the ICD-10 is really just three broad, very broad descriptions of three symptoms, and anybody, you know, you can't really run like a prevalence survey or anything like with it. But for example, like the PGSI has 9 items, but like we discussed a couple of times before, those are all equally weighted, right? Which means every item carries the same weight, no matter whether it's about health, finances, whether it's about, okay, you know, you lost a relationship or you've been criticized for it and so on and so forth. But the interesting thing is, if you are collecting answers to the PGSI from a sample of, you know, the population, and to try to find out how many, you know, groups of people actually can I detect in this answer. So we do this in methodologically with something called principal component analysis or factor analysis, then it's always one. So that's interesting, right? So it's says, okay, there's one dimension there and that's problem gambling. If somebody found, you know, if they had found or we'd find that there are 2 or 3 subgroups, it would mean there must be kind of, you know, subcategories. So I can sort of, you know, assign different weights to some of the 9 questions, but that's not the case. So it looks like those 9 questions are coming together based on one psychological dimension, psychological concept, problem gambling or gambling. I don't know if I managed to describe this now in a easy to understand way, but
it's
maybe
it's got to be easy to understand.
We gotta have somebody who is specialized in psychometric instruments. You know, somebody who works on, you know, questionnaires, who develops questionnaires like the PGSI or something else.
Well, it's good to have something to look forward to.
Absolutely.
Is
other than us.
Is that lack of standardization a problem?
I think it's in the nature of a young science that it develops over time.
Okay. What you're saying is we're both going to be dead before that happens.
I'm not so sure about you, but...
But you definitely will be. Okay. Now, we were talking before we hit record, because we're both going to Vegas in like a month or whatever it is. But while we're in Vegas, we're at the UNLV International Gaming Institute, or International Gam is it in Gaming Institute?
No, it's or Gambling called Institute? The Conference for Gambling and Risk Taking. That's what it's
yeah, called. But the organizer is the International Gambling Institute at yeah. UNLV Las Vegas. University of Nevada, Las Vegas, not UNLV Las Vegas, because that would be University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Las Vegas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that would be ridiculous. The risk taking and gambling conference that we're at, you're presenting a paper.
Absolutely.
That's exciting. Is anybody going to show up for it, do you think?
You?
I will be there, yes. I'm going to get one of those big foam gloves, you know, with the finger sticking up. So I'm going, hey, go on, Michael, go on.
Presenting a paper about differences in gambling behavior, like actual gambling behavior, you know, how much typical players are betting, losing, winning, depositing between different countries. So I had access to massive data sets from actual real world online casino players from the US, England, Germany, Netherlands, and Spain. So you might ask yourself, okay, why these five countries? And first, because they are regulatorily quite different, you know, the US being, I forgot Ontario. We also have Ontario, so it's six. Like Ontario, the Canadian province. And the US, of course, being regulatorily the most liberal of these. And on the other hand, you have Netherlands, Germany, I'd say the most, you know, regulated ones. And when I'm talking about regulated, I'm talking about aspects of regulation that I thought can have an impact on how a person gambles. So I'm not talking about regulation that, you know, sort of restricts the number of licenses or how hard it can be to get the license or how, you know, an operator can advertise to recruit players. I'm talking about regulatory aspects that sort of can have an impact on how much somebody spends or, you know, how often they play. And here I'm talking about, for example, are there limits on stakes on slots? And in the UK, there are limits. So you can only stake £5 on a slot spin. In Germany, it's €1. Then other maximum spending limits. And for example, in the Netherlands, maximum spending limits were introduced. So an adult, a normal player can deposit €700 a month. And a young adult between 18 and 24 can deposit €300. In Germany, we have €1,000 per month that can be exceeded if the individual applies. So they can then deposit up to 10 or 30K a month. And that goes along with, you know, very thorough monitoring, continuous monitoring. So these are the kinds of regulatory aspects I'm talking about. Or do players have to set limits or can they set limits, but they don't have to? And is there like a minimum game duration in slots? So in the UK, there are 2.5 seconds that have to elapse between two slot games. In Germany, it's 5 seconds. So yeah, so I looked at these six countries because they are quite different in terms of these regulatory aspects. And all of the details are going to be available in the publication, of course, which hopefully comes out during the next 30 days. And it's gonna be open access, so anybody, you know, can read the entire paper. And we're also going to present it in Las Vegas.
Okay. Is it any help if I'm on stage with you? I could point at stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, you're gonna hand out physical copies of the paper. I will personally sign them. There's gonna be a limited edition, of course.
Yeah, of course.
Up to 20. So they're gonna be.
Man, they'd be on eBay by the end of the day. You know, these gambling researchers alike.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Terrible. It's fucking academics always selling science stuff.
But so one thing, you know, I can mention is what I did is, so the question is then, you know, you ask yourself, okay, how do you compare? And then I came, I did this before. So one way to look at it is you analyze how equally spending is distributed across the player base, which means, are there a few players who contribute the majority of the revenue, right?
Yeah.
So this means if every player would exactly spend the same amount, we'd have a perfectly equal distribution. Right? Completely, okay, you know, the same across the player base. But let's say we had one guy who spends 5 million and in totality they make 6 million, then this guy would be responsible for, you know, whatever, 80% of the revenue. Of course, it's not that extreme, but what you see is it's unequally distributed, which is to be expected, right? Just like in many industries, that's not sort of limited to gambling. That's also happening, you know, in other areas. You typically see an unequal distribution. So you have a few who like the product more than the average customer. And in gambling, and especially casino gambling, it's even more skewed. So what do you think? So the 10% of the most extreme players, gamblers, let's say in the US, how much revenue are they accounting for?
You're asking me?
Yeah, asking you.
God, I don't know.
What's most of it?
Like 90%+.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in the US, when we talk about money bet, like money staked, then we have 80%, 88% of the revenue is accounted for by the 10% most intense players. And then in Germany, Netherlands, which I'd say, you know, are the most extremely regulated or most restricted environments, it goes down to 61% or 68%. So that makes quite a difference, right? So when you're in the US, where you basically there is no limit, maximum limit, players don't have to set the limit. Nobody is sort of cut off by any regulatory thresholds. We see that there is a minority of individuals which account for a really big chunk of the piece, right? Because simply, they can spend as much as they want. And so we have 10% on the one hand of the population and 88% of the cake on the other side. So in the Netherlands, we have 10% of the population contribute 66% of the cake, which makes quite a difference, right? So we see that the regulation, which, I mean, is something we naturally, of course, expect to happen, but, you know, you'll also have to show this academically, which, you know, is my job to do. We see that, the regulation really sort of translates into the gambling behavior.
But that's exciting. So you're presenting a paper and I'll just be hanging around, you know, making a nuisance of myself.
Recruiting podcast guests,
Trying to make it out we're all respectable.
Absolutely.
But I am excited to go and do it. And it's really coming up fast, isn't it?
Yep. May 22, a little bit over a month away, I think.
From when we're recording this, it'd be a little closer when this episode goes out.
Yeah, May 28, May 29.
Okay. So if you're not there, then you should be there. But we will be recording episodes of the podcast while we're there with some of the speakers.
Absolutely.
Because, we are talking about the Brains Trust of the RG side, of academics and researchers. You know, this event is where it's at. So that's why we're going.
The elite is going to be there.
And us.
And us, absolutely.
Although, to be fair, you're probably the elite, aren't you? But I'll be there to carry your suitcase.
Confidence into me.
I'll be there to carry your case and just tip my cap.
I have an assistant with me.
That's me, isn't it?
No, somebody else.
You have an assistant?
Absolutely, yeah. Now my brother is coming with me to Vegas.
Wow.
I mean, he's not yet aware. He thinks it's all about beer and wine and, you know, dancing and gambling, but there's serious stuff going on.
He's in for a bit of a shock then, isn't he?
No, I give him some pocket money and let him lose.
At night?
No. Curfew at 10.
But I'm personally, I'm hoping to catch up with some of my favorite people in Las Vegas. So I think it's going to be a blast. Yeah, it's going to be a nice trip. I haven't been to Vegas in 5 years. It probably all looks different now. And I've never stayed in the hotel that I'm staying at.
And you never will again.
That is very possible.
You're not staying in a Bellagio, are you?
No, I'm not. Although I gather UNLV sorted a really, really good room rate at the Bellagio. It was still out of my budget, unfortunately.
I told you we could have shared bunk beds.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. I'm staying at the Orleans, which is, it's only a few miles away. It's just around the corner. I think it's on Flamingo. So, it's literally like I can come out of the Orleans, take a left,
In my opinion, anything, you know, on the Strip is good. I like the Flamingo.
Yeah, I'm not on the Strip, Michael.
Yeah, I know where it is, but you can still, it's not far.
No, it's very reachable. I mean, it's a short taxi ride. And I will be, I got caught out in Vegas doing Uber one time, right? I was training for this race, which the race was an absolute disaster, as it turned out. But I needed to find a pool, and I found a 24-hour gym. And they had a pool, and I just needed to go and hit a couple of hours in the pool, right? Mm-hmm. So I get in there, and I did lengths for 2 hours, which is, you know, it's it's quite tiring. When I went down there, it was about 6:30, 7 o'clock in the evening. On a Friday, cost me like $20. So I made sure I got my money's worth out of the pool. Because when I left, it was after 9 on a Friday evening in Las Vegas. And the same trip cost me over $70. Mm. So I think there's a good argument there just for taxis rather than Uber. Anyway. Lesson learned. So that's us. Thank you for joining us for another episode. And of course, thanks to GLI for making this possible and making my attendance at the UNLV IGI Risk Taking and Gambling Conference possible. So big thank you. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.